Thanks, worship team. You can go ahead and grab your Bibles and turn to Matthew chapter 4. We got a lot of work to do this morning in like half an hour, so we are going to just fly this morning. Just a reminder, it's November 1st, so the November study booklets are on that little bookshelf by the Welcome Center. So if you're a life group leader or you just want to dive in a little bit deeper, we have a spot for sermon notes and then some questions that you can do throughout the week. So I would encourage you to grab one of those as all of our life groups hopefully are going to be going through this. So I was going to recap where we've been, but I'm not going to. So you can just listen online if you've missed. But we've spent 2 weeks, and this is the third, looking at the temptations of Jesus. And so we are on the last temptation this morning. And so what we'll do is we'll read a verse and then unpack it and read a verse and unpack it and do that for the four or so verses. In my opinion, this is the hardest temptation for Jesus. And some people say, well, he was God, so it's not really a big deal for him. I don't think that maybe the temptations were actually very tempting. And so I disagree with that. I think these temptations were very trying for Jesus. And specifically, I believe that this last one was very difficult for Jesus, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But why don't we start in Matthew 4, and we'll read verse 8 together, starting there. So it says this, "Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory." So what is happening here is Satan takes Jesus to a mountain and all the kingdoms of the world, and what it means when he says, and their glory, so their fame and their achievements and their power and their riches and their rulers, everything that makes those nations great passes before Jesus. Jesus sees all of them. And again, immediately in our 2015 mindset, we go, wait a second. So he was in the wilderness. Then him and Satan walked to the temple, climbed the temple, and now he's on some high mountain that you can see all the kingdoms of the world. I don't think that mountain exists. Even if you climbed Mount Everest, you can't see all the kingdoms of the world. So what is happening here? I think we have to understand that something supernatural is going on here. And actually, in Luke's account, he adds in, showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. So actually what is happening here is not just the first century kingdoms. Satan is showing Jesus all the kingdoms of the world that will ever be, including Canada, including the United States, including Babylon and Rome and Assyria and all Russia and all the kingdoms of the world that will ever be, from past to present in Jesus' time to future. In a moment of time, Jesus sees all of these things. So I don't think we have to worry about, well, what mountain was it? How could he actually see? It was a supernatural event where the kingdoms of the world and their glory passed before Jesus' eyes. And now some of us might go, well, that doesn't seem like a big deal. If I was standing there and I saw all the kingdoms of the world, I don't know if I would be tempted with that. You see Canada and the U.S. and Russia and Babylon and Assyria and all of their great things. I don't know if I would actually fall for that temptation. Maybe it wasn't a big deal, but like I said, we're going to get to that this was a massive temptation for Jesus. So verse 9, what exactly is the temptation? Satan shows him all the kingdoms of the world, and in verse 9 it says, "And he said to him, all these I will give you, if you will fall down and worship me." So the temptation is, Jesus, everything that you've just seen, all the kingdoms of the world, all of their power, all of their glory, all of their riches, all the rulers of all the kingdoms, if you just bow down to me, this is Satan speaking, I'll give you all of it. Very interesting temptation. What Satan here is doing here, again, is attempting to take Jesus' eyes off of his mission of the cross. Essentially, Satan is saying, we even saw it last week. He says, waste some time, Jesus. Jump off the building and float around. And then also, gain a mass following and they'll make you king by force. And so even last week, Satan is attempting to take Jesus' eyes off of the cross. And he's doing the same thing in our temptation this morning. Satan is offering Jesus the end result, but he's offering it by bypassing the cross. So we know that one day all the kingdoms of the world are going to bow down to Jesus anyways. So Satan is saying, I'll give that to you right now, and you can just forget about the cross. You don't have to die. You can have the end result right now, instantly. Just bow down to me, and all the nations will bow down to you. It's the shortcut that would sidestep God's redemptive plan on the cross. Malcolm Muggeridge, which is a fantastic name, he says this: Jesus had but to give a nod of agreement, and he could have constructed Christendom, not on four shaky gospels and a defeated man nailed to a cross, but on the basis of sound socio-economic planning and principles. Every utopia could have been brought to pass, every hope have been realized, every dream been made to come true. What a benefactor then Jesus would have been. Acclaimed equally in the London School of Economics and the Harvard Business School, a statue in Parliament Square, and an even bigger one on Capitol Hill and in the Red Square. Instead, he turned the offer down on the ground that only God should be worshipped. I love how Malcolm words that. In an instant, just with a nod of his head, Christendom would have been built. The entire world would have been under Jesus' authority. A statue in every capital city. If you think of our parliament, instead of statues of former prime ministers, it would be a gigantic statue of Jesus in every country. All the nations would have been bowing down towards or to him. Every utopia you could imagine, every dream fulfilled. And so we go, well, why didn't Jesus do that? If you're going to receive that anyway, so if the end result, Jesus, is that you would have all of that anyways, why wouldn't you just receive, or why wouldn't you just do that? The problem with this temptation is that Jesus would have established an earthly kingdom, and every human being on the planet would have gone to hell. That's where this temptation breaks down. Jesus would have established an earthly kingdom, and every single man, woman, boy, and girl would have spent eternity in hell. And the reason is, earthly kingdoms and Christendom and Christian nations don't save souls. And it's interesting because I hear all the time, well, Canada was built on Christian principles, and all the founding fathers of the United States, they were all Christians, and the Declaration of Independence is a Christian document, and this and that. And that's all fantastic, but that doesn't save souls. So really we go, great that it was built on Christian principles, but that doesn't save your soul that you live in a Christian nation. That means diddly squat in the kingdom of God. Only the death and the resurrection of Jesus saves someone. And if Jesus had fallen into this temptation, then humanity would have been doomed. It would have been utopia on earth. And when you died, you would have spent eternity in hell. We would have been doomed. There would have been no payment for sin and no salvation. But here's the thing. Jesus is after your soul. He's after your heart. And he's not interested in building an earthly kingdom. He's not interested in being made a king by force and demanding nations to bow down to him. He's not interested in that. He's interested in hearts. He's interested in people. And really, this last temptation is about power, because with power, power can force obedience, but only love can summon a response of love. So Jesus, by power, if he had been given power of all the nations, yes, he could have forced obedience from the planet, but only love can summon a response of love. That's why when you look at all the dictators that have ever lived and even that are living now, yes, they can force obedience because of their power, but they can't force someone to love them. Only love summons a response of love, which is why we'll read that Jesus rejects this temptation. Jesus desperately wants our hearts. He's not interested in building an earthly kingdom. Even when Jesus was brought before Pilate at his trial, he spoke of his kingdom not being an earthly one. So in John 18, verse 36, Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews, but my kingdom is not from the world." Then Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." Pilate said to him, What is truth? I love it. Pilate is so postmodern. Even, you know, so many of us, what is truth? Truth is relative. There is no such thing as truth. And so all of these smart people saying that, well, Pilate said the same thing 2,000 years ago, so it's not new. What is truth? Pilate says that. But it's key that Jesus says, my kingdom's not of this world. That's why when Peter cut off the servant's ear in the garden, Jesus said, no. And he stopped him from doing that. And he says, if I was building an earthly kingdom, then yeah, my servants would be fighting and killing people so that I wouldn't have been arrested. But he says, my kingdom is not of this world. He didn't come to establish an earthly kingdom. He came for the hearts of men and women, which is why he was so focused on the cross throughout his entire ministry. And so we might ask, so then is this really a temptation then? If Jesus was so focused on the cross, isn't Satan kind of wasting his time by throwing this temptation of power? And I think this was a massive temptation for Jesus, because although he was obedient to go to the cross, I believe that he knew how absolutely brutal it was going to be. And there's a few verses that show us this. Luke 12:50. Jesus says, I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how great is my distress until it's accomplished. Jesus is talking about his death, the baptism of the wrath of God on the cross, and he's saying, I'm stressed out about it. He says, I have a baptism, the wrath of God against the sins of humanity are going to be poured out onto me on the cross, and I'm stressed out about it. Jesus knew that that was coming. Even in the garden before he's arrested, Jesus wrestles with this. Matthew 26:38. Then he said to them, my soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me. And going a little farther, he fell on his face and he prayed, saying, my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. And we read in another account that Jesus is so anxious, so stressed out, that he actually sweats blood. And he's saying, God, if there's any other way, could you make that possible? It's almost like, I don't want to do this. And the cup that he's talking about is the cup of God's wrath. And he's saying, please, don't let me do this. And yet we see him say, but it's not what I want, it's what you want. And he submits himself. But he was stressed out about it. I think Jesus knew that it was going to be brutal. He knew that he was going to be tortured. He knew that it was going to be the worst pain imaginable. And even more than that, the spiritual pain of having God's anger poured out onto him. He wasn't excited about it. So I think that this was a huge temptation, because Jesus knew where his life was headed. Jesus knew the physical and spiritual pain of the cross, and Satan here is saying, well, don't do it. You know where it's headed. Don't do that, Jesus. I will give you the end result right now, and you don't have to do it. This is why it was a big temptation for Jesus, I believe. Satan is saying, I'm going to give you what is going to be yours, and you won't have to do what God wants you to do, to suffer and to die. So let's look at Jesus' response in verse 10. Then Jesus said to him, begone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and were ministering to him. This is huge. And Jesus' response really should leave us in awe. I think I said it last week, but one of my goals when I stand up here every week is that we would just be in awe of Jesus. That when we leave, it's almost like our jaws would be dropped going, that's unbelievable. Jesus is unbelievable. And this resistance that Jesus shows to this last temptation, that should trigger that response that we go, wow, Jesus is awesome. Jesus is amazing that he would resist that. Here's why this should trigger that response. All throughout these temptations, and even Jesus' whole life, Jesus succeeds where Adam and Eve fell. Jesus succeeds where Israel fell over and over and over again. And Jesus succeeds where you and I mess up and fail over and over and over again. And over again, Jesus succeeds where no one else can succeed. And it's amazing because he succeeded on our behalf. Jesus has this option given to him. Satan says, bow down to me and I'll give you power, glory, worship. Every nation will bow down towards you. And the alternative that Jesus knows is pain, suffering, rejection, humiliation, torture, and murder. And Jesus chooses this one. That's unbelievable. Any other person, including all of us, would have chosen this one. Death and suffering and being rejected or having every single person bow down to you. We would all choose this one. And that's why we should just be in awe that Jesus would willingly choose this option. That he would do that on our behalf. That we would have a chance at eternal life. Jesus' response to Satan's temptation is, "Begone, Satan." And in our English language, it's so weak. In the Greek, it's translated much more aggressively. It kind of just sounds like Jesus is, "Be gone, Satan. Satan, could you do me a favor? Could you leave me alone? I need to be alone." It's not that. In the Greek, it's almost as if he is yelling at Satan. It's much more forceful. It's, "Begone, Satan. Leave. Get out of here." It's much more aggressive. And the same type of word is used in Matthew 16. It says, "From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, 'Far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you.' But he turned and he said to Peter, 'Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man.'" First off, poor Peter. We just go, "Oh man, can you imagine?" He's probably trying to be all nice and, man, calls him Satan. That's not fun. but it's that same type of aggressive word in the Greek. "Get behind me. Get out of here. Leave." And Jesus is forcefully commanding Satan to leave. For Jesus, this temptation was a worship issue. He was tempted to place power and the kingdoms of the world over his obedience to God. So it was a worship issue for Jesus, which is why in his response he quotes Deuteronomy 6:13, "You shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." So he says, "No, I worship God. I'm not going to worship the power, the potential power, the kingdoms of the world. I'm not going to worship you, Satan. I worship God." For Jesus, this was a temptation, I believe, to make power his idol. And this is a huge principle for us because every single one of us is going to be tempted to make something besides God our God. And so we spent 10 weeks talking about idolatry, so I'm not going to rehash it. But all of us will be tempted to take things or ideas or people or whatever and make them God. And so for some of us, it might be power. You might be tempted to place power above the worship of God. For some of you, it might be beauty, and you're obsessed with beauty, and you spend hours looking in the mirror, and people get plastic surgery and do all sorts of things to make themselves beautiful. The ancients had a name for that god. It was Aphrodite, but we're so advanced that we don't call it that, but we worship the exact same thing. Or you might worship money. And so you need money and you just are greedy and you need to buy things and you have to have better things and you work and you work and you work and you're hoarding money. The ancients had a god called Mammon and it was the exact same thing. We don't call it Mammon, we just call it money. And so whatever it is, sex, love, your job, relationships, your family, we all are tempted to take things and make them gods in our life. And so we spent weeks talking about that. But this is important for us. All throughout our lives, we're going to be tempted to worship other things. Human beings are always worshiping. It's not as if we just come on Sundays or we wake up and we go, "Oh, it's Sunday. Bing, turn my worship switch on and come and pray." And then when I leave, I just bing, turn it off. And then I just kind of live the rest of my week. And then next Sunday, it's Sunday, time to worship. Bing, "Oh, I love you, Jesus." And then bing, turn it off. That's not how it works. Human beings are always worshiping. Always. God created us as worshipers. So there is no worship switch. You are always worshiping. It just depends on what you're worshiping. And God designed it that we would always be worshiping him But so often we take that worship and we just direct it at other things. Human beings are always worshiping. And Jesus' response is key. He's tempted to make power his idol. He's tempted to bow down to Satan and to forget about his mission and place the kingdoms of the world above his obedience to God. And his response is key. Get out of here, Satan. I worship God. I don't worship anything else. I don't worship you. I don't worship power. I worship God, even if that means the cross. This is huge. We have to get this. By Jesus saying, I worship God only, that meant that he was going to die. So regardless of your circumstances, will you worship God only? So if God decides to bankrupt you and you lose your house and your money and your RSP and everything, would you still say, I worship God, I don't need money? Or if God would take your beauty away, would you say, yes, I worship God? If God takes your family away, would you be able to say, I worship God no matter what the circumstance? That's what Jesus is saying. I worship God only, even though I'm going to be rejected and humiliated and despised and spit on and tortured and murdered. No matter what life throws at me, I worship God. And so we all have that opportunity to say that. But so often we go, I worship God, but I kind of need this new thing or whatever. Or I worship God, but if my family ever got taken away, I don't know if I could believe in God anymore. And so we kind of play that game. I worship God, but. And Jesus is showing us that we say, no, I worship God no matter what. No matter what the life circumstance is, I worship God. That's what Jesus says here. Satan will offer us these things to take our eyes off of worshiping God. He will offer you success or power or empire building or health or wealth or glory or beauty or fame or whatever it is. And he's attempting to take your eyes off of Jesus. And it's fascinating because this is what he did in the garden. Satan has no new tricks. He offers the same thing. He goes to Adam and Eve and he says, really, did God say that? You're not going to die. Your eyes will be open. You'll actually be like God. Power. He says, you're going to be like God. God was lying to you. You're actually no good from evil. And so he has no new tricks. He's doing the same thing to Jesus. Bow down to me and I'll give you all this power. Did God really say that? No, you're just going to be like God. So how do we apply this? Because I thought for a really long time on what we could take away, not only from this third temptation, but from the entire temptation narrative. Because I think oftentimes churches are really interested in behavior modification, but not in discipleship. And so oftentimes it'll be like, okay, well then go and don't sin. Go and clean up your life and stop doing bad things. And then we all leave and we all go do bad things and we feel terrible about ourselves. So I thought a really long time, well, how do we apply this then? Is there actually freedom from temptation? How do you actually put sin to death in your own life? What can we kind of draw from this so it's not just in our own power, we'll stop doing bad things and then go and then we'll just all be depressed because we can't do it. So I thought for a long time, what do we want to pull from this to help us? Because like I said 3 weeks ago, if we're really honest, all of us are being tempted all the time. If you take off that fake veneer that we put up of my life is all together, I never sin, I never get tempted. If we're actually honest, we're all tempted every day. So is there actually freedom from that? Is it just something that we just have to kind of wrestle with till the day we die? And so I thought of three things that I want to leave with you to hopefully help us have some victory, to help us resist temptation, to help us put sin to death. So first off, reading about the temptation of Jesus should leave us in awe of him. And I've already said this. He succeeded. This is huge. He didn't sin. He didn't fall into temptation. He did what Adam and Eve failed to do. He did what Israel failed to do. He does what you and I fail to do every day. He succeeded. And that should leave us in awe of Jesus. This is incredible. And it should leave us in a state of wonder and awe and comfort because Jesus succeeds when we fail. Jesus succeeded on your behalf. C.S. Lewis says this, only those who resist temptation know how strong it is. We never find out the strength of the evil impulse inside of us until we try and fight it. And Christ, because he was the only man who never yielded to temptation, is also the only man who knows to the full what temptation means. The only complete realist. What Lewis is saying is that you actually only know what temptation is when you actually resist it. And so because Jesus was tempted and he's the only person that has ever resisted temptation, he's the only person that actually really knows what temptation is. And so when you and I are tempted, we can take comfort in that and go to Jesus because he's the only person that actually knows what it means to be tempted. Because when we're tempted, we just all the time fall into temptation. So we don't know what it means to resist. That should give us comfort because Hebrews 2:18, talking about Jesus, says, "For because he himself has suffered suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted." Hebrews 4:15, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace." This should be massively comforting to you, that because Jesus resisted temptation, we can actually draw near to him when we are tempted because he knows exactly what it means, more so than any of us do. But often when we're tempted, we don't turn to Jesus. We just kind of in our own strength, well, I can beat this temptation, or then we sin, and then some people for weeks don't approach God because they feel dirty and they feel like, "Ugh, I'm so stained by sin, I don't want to go to God." And the first person we should turn to when we're tempted is Jesus. Not just, "Oh, okay, well, I'm just going to try and resist on my own." We should be saying, "Help me, Jesus. God, I'm being tempted. Jesus, help me. I can't do this." That's what we should do when we're tempted. Not, "Well, I'm, for men who are tempted with lust, well, I'm just going to, you know, walk into poles as I keep my head, eyes on the ground." Yes, that's good. But when you're tempted to lust, for instance, you should just close your eyes. "Help me, Jesus." If the Bible is true, Jesus was tempted in every way we were. So we go, "Jesus, I can't do this. I need you, help me." And we cling to the fact that he can comfort us because he resisted temptation. We cling to Jesus and his success in our moments of weakness. Secondly, one of the ways I believe we actually fight temptation is believing that God has something better for us. So often our temptations come on a physical, temporal, instant satisfaction, instant gratification level. And resisting temptation actually believes that God has something better for you than what is right here, right now, in the moment. If you look at all three temptations, Satan does this. He offers Jesus, you know, "Turn these stones into bread. Instantly satisfy your hunger right now." Or, "Jump off this building, Jesus. Instantly gain a mass crowd and be made king and have that fame instantly." Or, "Jesus, bow down to me and you can have that end result right now, instantly." Satan offers that on all three temptations, instant gratification. And one of the ways that we resist temptation is that we believe that God has something better for us. So Satan says, "Turn stones to bread," and Jesus says, "Well, man doesn't live on bread alone." There's a whole nother spiritual reality that we're not even talking about here. And God may have something better for you. Satan says, "Jump off this building," and Jesus says, "Well, don't test God. I'm not going to pursue fame and popularity and comfort and ease, because I believe that God has something better for me. Here's all the kingdoms of the world. Here's all their glory and all their power." And Jesus says, no, I'm going to worship God only because I believe that he has something better. And all of us can say that. We have to believe that, whether it's something physically better, I don't know, but on a spiritual, eternal reality that we live in, God does have something better for us. And when we're tempted, we should cling to that. Instead of in the physical, right here, right now moment of temptation, God has something far better for us. And I believe that that will help us resist. Lastly, and this is the hard one to hear, and we'll end with this, but fighting temptation and putting sin to death hurts. It's not instant gratification. And many, many times, fighting and resisting temptation and putting sin to death in your life is painful. Very painful. It's not a pleasant feeling. In the book, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader by C.S. Lewis, there's a character named Eustace. And in one of the chapters, he kind of wanders off and he finds this cave, and there's a great pile of treasure and a dragon sleeping on top of it. And so he sneaks into the cave and he puts on one of those golden bracelets and he falls asleep. And I'm paraphrasing this. And he wakes up and he finds out that he's turned into the dragon. And this golden bracelet is so tight on his wrist. And so he stays a dragon for a while, trying to figure out, how can I go back to being a boy? And Aslan comes, and all throughout the Chronicles of Narnia, Aslan is so clearly represented as Jesus. And he comes and he leads Eustace, who's a dragon, to this marble pool with these marble steps and cold, refreshing water in it. And he says, go and swim. But Aslan says, but you need to get undressed first. And so Eustace the dragon begins scratching at his scales, and scales are falling off. And finally, he takes a layer of skin off and he goes to get in, but he's still a dragon. So he does it again, and he rips and he pulls another layer off, and he does it a third time, but he's still a dragon every time. And I want to read to you what happens here, because this is a perfect example of how painful resisting temptation and how painful putting sin to death can be. Then the lion said, but I don't know if it spoke, you will have to let me undress you. I was afraid of his claws, I can tell you, but I was pretty nearly desperate now. So I just lay flat on my back to let him do it. The very first tear he made was so deep that I thought it had gone right into my heart. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I've ever felt. The only thing that made me able to bear it was just the pleasure of feeling the stuff peel off. You know, if you've ever picked the scab of a sore place, it hurts like Billy. Oh, but it is such fun to see it coming away. I know exactly what you mean, said Edmund. Well, he peeled that beastly stuff right off, just as I thought I'd done it myself the other three times, only they hadn't hurt. And there it was, lying on the grass, only ever so much thicker and darker and more knobbly looking than the others had been. And there was I, as smooth and soft as a peeled switch, and smaller than I had been. Then he caught hold of me. I didn't like that much, for I was very tender underneath, now that I'd no skin on, and he threw me into the water. It smarted like anything, but only for a moment. After that, it became perfectly delicious, and as soon as I started swimming and splashing, I found that all the pain had gone from my arm. And then I saw why I'd turned into a boy again. I believe that C.S. Lewis, yes, is telling a fantastic kid's story, but he is speaking on a whole nother level about what it means to resist temptation and put sin to death, and such an accurate description, because it's painful, it hurts, and like he said, it feels like, oh, the claws are going right into my heart, but after it's over, oh man, is it the best feeling in the world. And so you need to hear that as you seek to put sin to death in your life, it's going to hurt. And as you resist temptation and you say no to earthly, physical, instant gratification, oftentimes that's going to hurt. But it's so worth it. It is so worth it when you realize the alternative. And really, I love how he says that I had done it three times, and yet it wasn't good enough, because in our own power, none of us can do this on our own. We need Aslan, we need Jesus to rip that out of our lives. And so resisting temptation and putting sin to death is just submitting that part of your life to Jesus and saying, God, would you remove it? Holy Spirit, would you chip that part of my life away, even though it hurts, even though it's painful, would you do that? Would you pray with me? So Jesus, I thank you that you are the only person who has ever resisted temptation, that you have done what none of us can do. And because of that, Jesus, you went to the cross, and that we can have freedom from sin, and actually any of this is possible because of your death and resurrection. Jesus, we desperately don't want to just modify our behavior in our own strength and spend the rest of our lives just seeking to be good enough people, because that's impossible. So Jesus, I pray that the truth of your gospel would sink deep into our hearts, even when it hurts, and that you would begin to rip that sin away, that you would begin to chip away at the things in our life that aren't pleasing to you. Jesus, we submit to you that you have permission to do that. I pray that everyone here would be willing to place their lives in your hand, like Eustace just allowed Aslan to do his work on him. Because Jesus, it's so worth it. You have things that are so much better for us than the instant gratification of our temptations. So help us, Jesus. We desperately need your help. I pray that as we leave this place and we go into the regular areas of life, God, when we are tempted, and we will be, Jesus, that we would cry out to you first to help us. And Jesus, when we fail, and we will, that we will spend less time looking at us and more time looking at you and what you've done and the fact that you succeeded on our behalf. And Jesus, you are so worth all of our worship and our praise, and every knee and every tongue will confess that you are Lord, because you were faithful and obedient to God to go to the cross. And so we worship you. Help us in our temptations, God. Help us to walk with you and to grow more like you, Jesus. Amen.